It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll learn why our mild winter suddenly got very cold and how much longer this weather should last.
First, since the decommissioning of Wisconsin's Badger Army Ammunition Plant in the late 90s, there's been a lot of debate over what should be done with the land and who should get it.
Now, after years of political wrangling, a good deal of that land is officially being returned to its original caretakers, the Ho-Chunk Tribe. Last month, the federal government gave its approval to return over 1,500 acres of the land to the Ho-Chunk, and there are a lot of ideas as to what to do with that land going forward.
Joining us now to talk about that land transfer and what it means to the tribe is John Greendeer. He's the president of the Ho-Chunk Nation. President Greendeer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
The land we're talking about has seen many different functions as well as owners over the decades. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the Ho-Chunk's ties to that land?
Well, absolutely. The history, obviously, I'm only 170 years old, so I can't go too far back. But, you know, the history has is rich in cultural oral tradition, and it speaks highly of an area that was used for ceremonial purposes. Items today that you can find archaeologically to show effigy mounds, systems, old dwellings, just a number of places, but also places where our people went to fast, to live, to collect medicines, to hunt. It's in an area, and, honestly, I can say a lot of Wisconsin has a lot of deep cultural history with the Ho-Chunk people, but this area in particular, in proximity to Devil's Lake, has a lot of stories, a lot of items and ties to our people modern day that, can look back and see the rich history, even in today's modern lens, how the Ho-Chunk used to live a long time ago.
And what is the story of the removal of the Ho-Chunk and their access to that land?
Well, we had entered into a treaty in 1837, and since then, the nation, with the pressure for all tribes, all natives to move westward, we have went through a devastating amount of land loss through a government policy of removals, and even to the point of where the Ho-Chunk people were gathered up in rail cars and shipped in winter, such as we're dealing with today in the state, and sent out to, Iowa and Minnesota and ultimately Nebraska. And, our stories in our history tells us that we've walked back, at least 11 times on these areas to come back to a land that has always been Ho-Chunk land. And, it's been through this policy of removal and even extermination that, we've survived. Our numbers were decimated. And, at that time, in the, late 30s, early 40s, we had a property that was designated by Representative William Stevenson out of South Carolina to host an ammunition plant. And, and this ended up moving not only the older Ho-Chunk settlements, but also the colonial European settlements that were there as well. So archaeologically speaking, you kind of see a layer of the old, frontier settlements that were there, the European settlements, but you go back and it is absolutely rich with our own history, some of the minerals that we used for carving pipes, pipestone, some of the waterways. So, obviously this has been something that is an immense amount of history that, I hope someday we're able to caption out for folks that may not have the, contemporary understanding of what it means today for the Ho-Chunk people.
Now, this decision from the decommission of the plant to the decision to give a large parcel of it back to the Ho-Chunk, this took 15 years. Why did it take so long?
I actually think I would argue it took longer than that. I had to, I was beside myself building the timeline about when this actually originated, in the late 80s, when there was even, the premonition that this was going to be coming up as excess land. And I start looking through the history, and I'm beside myself, because the names that I see are my heroes, my personal heroes of the Ho-Chunk Nation. These were leaders that I don't think they make a lot of today. And this endeavor took so long, you know, because of, you know, the bureaucracies that we create on ourselves, but much, you know, to the, credit of our United States federal government in disposing of property, especially, I think one of the biggest factors that we can't overlook is the contamination level. And if you are the federal government and your responsibility is to make a decision in the best interest of those tribes, and you look at, you know, what your own agencies have done to this property, it's hard to imagine standing by a decision to support delivering this land back to Native people, whether they're Ho-Chunk or not, because of the disposition of that land environmentally. And so a lot of this in that 15 or greater years has been an effort from the United States federal government to do a lot of reclamation at their expense. And I'm so happy that, you know, Senator Baldwin had made sure that when we went forward with this, that it is a polluter pays piece of legislation. And so, you know, we take some comfort in that, but it also has been one of those mitigating factors in reclaiming that land that, you know, we've been dealing with not just the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but also the EPA, the Office of Solicitor General, different other agencies, along with, you know, on the legislative route. So it's been, you know, and when you have a government that, you know, has, you know, that turns over like any other government, you may not have that consistent drive. And I think the federal government, in hoping that we would just go away, found out that we weren't going to, and the effort was just going to get stronger. And I certainly am thankful to all of the allies that we've encountered throughout this plight to receive our land back.
This has been a long time in the making. And now the next step, the next question is, what happens with this land? I know there aren't decisions made, but what kind of ideas are out there for what to do with this former Badger ammo plant land?
Well, one of the first things I often hear is, so when can we go hunt there? You know, hey, we're Wisconsin. That's what we like to do. Mm-hmm. You know, first and foremost, just to put things in perspective, the Ho-Chunk Nation, since its formation, has acquired just under 10,000 acres, and only half of that is in trust. So about 4,100 acres are in trust status. Of that 4,100 acres, 1,200 acres belong to the Kickapoo Valley, in which has restrictions on there that we cannot develop, put housing, gaming, you know, economic development, government infrastructure, agriculture, do forestry. So it's basically, you know, 1,200 acres of non-usable land. So we don't have a lot of trust land. This certainly increases our inventory 37% in terms of our trust land base. And we are not, you know, prohibited from doing a lot of things, but there are some, you know, pretty significant limitations. And what we're looking at, you know, first and foremost, I think that the first thing a nation has to do to be responsible, not only to itself, but also to the constituents and the community, is make sure that we have a sustainability plan in place. 1,500 acres of land is a lot of property. And there's fencing, there's buildings, there's roadways, there's, you know, utilities, there's infrastructure. There are items there that are, over the course of a long period of time, going to take resources in order to maintain. And I think our first responsibility is ensuring that we have a sustainability plan in place. The next portion, I think, is absolutely important, is to make sure that we have thorough testing. Now, you know, a lot of us folks that aren't really, you know, gifted with a lot of environmental wisdom will walk around saying it's polluted, or it's not polluted, or it's kind of polluted. We need to be responsible and make sure we know exactly if there is a level of contamination there that, you know, poses a threat or harm, that we know exactly what that is. So before I say, hey, let's go do a deer drive out there, we need to make sure what are the impacts over the course of this development of munitions on the wildlife, on the water resources that we have, on the soil, on the air, you know. And I think it's, you know, incumbent on us to make sure that we have a pretty comprehensive assessment, our own assessment, so that we can make sure that we don't have adverse impacts to not only the existing environment, but also to the community and those who attend. And finally, I want to ask you,
as we have just a little bit of time here,
yeah.
What would you say this reclamation of land means to the Ho-Chunk?
Oh, my. This has been significant. And internally, it has gone back and forth because there's two types of land that tribes typically have. There are fee land, which is land that you and I would both purchase if we purchased a hunting property or a home. And then there's trust land, in which the federal government goes through an exhaustive, sometimes decade-long application process to secure in federal trust, which prevents it from any sales, encumbrances, and those type of things. But those are areas in which the tribe has complete jurisdiction over it. As of today, we do have that now, as of passage of this act on December 19th signature. So what this means is this is our land. And, you know, this is something that this is a crowning achievement. I remember having everyone in my office watching the floor statement from Senator Baldwin, who was absolutely instrumental. Her and her team made this happen for our nation. And listening to this floor statement and just welling up inside because, you know, we got to be a part of this history. And, you know, whether or not, you know, this land isn't going to pick up and go anywhere. You know, if it takes 100 years for this earth, our grandmother, to heal herself, then we're going to be here for 100 years to see that happen. So, you know, this is somewhat, I can say, you know, aside from the contamination that, you know, was put on by the federal government, you know, at that time, I want to say this can be looked at as restorative justice. And I am very, very proud to be a part of this, a small part of this great history that we have made for our people.
John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having us. We're pretty excited. And again, I'd just like to thank everyone through the decades, and a lot of the people that deserve the gratitude aren't on this earth anymore, but I'm sure that they are looking down with great pride on the efforts that were made on behalf of our future.
That was Ho-Chunk Nation President John Greendeer. He joined us to talk about the deal that turned over 1,500 acres of Sauk Prairie land back to the Ho-Chunk Nation, part of the former Badger Army ammo plant. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll ask you, if you like this bitterly cold weather that we've been having, what tips do you have for making it through cold spells like the one that we're in right now? And we'll be taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can call us in just a few minutes.
First, we have Michael Morgan here to explain why it's so cold here and in most of the country right now. Michael Morgan is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So, pretty mellow winter so far up till now. I don't want to complain too much, but why did it get bitterly cold all of a sudden?
Well, this is just our normal process of proceeding through the season. For meteorologists, winter, you know, begins in a climatological sense in early December, and we did have a really mild December pattern, but over the last several weeks, there have been indications that we're going to see amplification of the weather pattern across the whole globe, particularly in the northern hemisphere, and that leads to the development of a northwesterly flow over much of North America. And that, as typically happens this time of year, can bring down some rather cold air. And so we're just in a cold air mass, which is, quite frankly, typical of this time of year. It is below normal, but we have those periods every winter above and below normal, and that all averages out to give us what we call our normal or average temperature during this time of the year.
Now, I think what's happening a bit this year is that we get this cold weather, these, you know, 20, 30 below zero temperatures that are possible in the coming days, and we immediately think back to last year when it was well beyond a typical winter. It was a really cold, really, really difficult, brutal winter in lots of ways. Is this a harbinger that this is another kind of winter like that?
Probably not. And the reason we see that is that some of the patterns that we've seen across the Northern Hemisphere the last couple of winters, not just last winter or the winter before, have changed a little bit. A patch of ocean temperatures in the North Pacific just south of Alaska had been, and the air above that had been above normal for the last couple of winters, and that's changed a little bit colder, and so that suggests that perhaps the large-scale flow over the continental United States is going to be a little bit different. And I think if we look at the NOAA's seasonal forecast, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's forecast for both the this month, it has us, particularly the western and northern part of the state, likely below normal. The tendency for it's most likely going to be below normal there, but for the balance of the remaining months of this season into March, so January, February, March, actually has us sort of equal chances for above and below normal. Doesn't mean we're not going to get very cold, but it also suggests that we could have some times in which we're above normal. So there's no clear signal to a much colder than normal winter like we had that signal last year, but not this year. It's not as strong.
Now, as you say, this isn't freakishly cold for Wisconsin. This happens. Are there parts of the country that are getting much colder, unusually colder than usual temperatures out there?
That's an excellent question. And when I was contacted about possibly being on your show this afternoon, I did a quick look at record temperatures across the globe, but particularly across North America. And frankly, you'll see a preponderance of slightly above normal temperatures over the western United States, where the flow is out of the southwest. But over much of the continental part of the United States and southern Canada, the last couple of days have actually been about normal. There's nothing, no record, certainly no record-setting temperatures. Doesn't mean it's above normal or below normal, no record-setting temperatures. So this really is just in the range of the types of variability we expect every winter.
Now, last year, the buzzword was polar vortex. I'm assuming that we're not in another one of those. What is the difference between what we're experiencing now and last year's polar vortex?
Frankly, there is not much of a difference. The polar vortex refers to winds that are generally westerly across the northern hemisphere, encircling the pole. And it's manifest at the surface by where the polar front is, which is sort of the demarcation between the cold air north of the front and the relatively warm air south of that front. And over the course of any winter, particularly during the winter, we see that front moving north and south, crossing our area, so we get periods of warm, periods of cold. Last winter, the temperatures north of that front were a little bit colder than they are this year. The front has moved to our south. The notion of using the term polar vortex isn't really too helpful for people to understand what's going on. But the between last year and this year, it's just, again, we were getting unseasonably colder temperatures, and perhaps we had a few more records set last winter than we're going to see in this current outbreak. But I think the only difference is in slightly the degree of cold. But this is, again, I wouldn't put this weather that we're experiencing too far outside the realm of what we see generally each winter. I guess if you look at the history of the last few decades, we haven't seen many of these intrusions as much, and so that's why people are probably a little bit noticing this a bit more in the last couple of years than we have than we would have if this were just, again, 2 decades ago.
One thing that felt a bit abnormal was a lack or a very limited amount of snow in December. We've had a little bit now coming along with this cold. Do we have a prognosis for how much snow we're supposed to get over the rest of the winter?
Okay. What you're indicating is right on the mark. We're actually about 10 inches, 8 to 10 inches below normal for this, through our season so far for snowfall. We had most of the snow we've seen so far this year was in the month of November. Mm-hmm. And in December, we only had a trace of snow. Looking forward, our next shot at any accumulating snow is actually going to be during Thursday afternoon and evening when we get our next slug of really cold air coming back in. But if you look ahead for the next week, the chances of our getting more than an inch or two of snow are pretty remote. So it looks like we're going to be, our snow deficit is probably going to continue for at least another week or two. No big storms on the horizon.
In the summer, you hear people say, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. In the winter, it seems like you hear people say, it's not the temperature, it's the wind chill. What do we know about the kinds of wind chills we're going to be seeing?
So the wind chill that we're going to experience in the Weather Service has issued for southern Wisconsin, this is from Milwaukee, a wind chill advisory, which is basically for wind chills anywhere from 20 to 34 below zero, and with winds greater than at least 4 miles per hour. And wind chill basically is just a measure of the sort of the temperature that, we as humans are experiencing with any slight wind with these really extreme cold temperatures just makes it feel that much colder with the wind blowing across our skin. And our body's response to that is to pump more blood toward the skin, and that can lead to all sorts of complications. So we're looking at the possibility of wind chills approaching 34 below zero over southern Wisconsin for at least over the next day or so.
Now, the big winter weather story so far this season, I guess, has to be the Buffalo area massive dump of snow some weeks back. How likely is that kind of weird event, or is it just so random that it's hard to predict until you get a couple days out from it?
That was a well-forecasted event, actually, mm-hmm. for the Buffalo area. In fact, this past Christmas, I drove through the area expecting to see snow, and it's pretty much gone, which is, I guess, nice for those guys. But those sorts of events are well predicted. Lake effect snow is a pretty, you know, there are a few factors that people look at. One of the key things is the difference between the lake temperature and the temperature about a mile or so up, mile and a half above the lake. The wind direction, if you have a nice fetch across the lake, and so that's something that's pretty well, pretty easy to forecast. And you, as long as you know the conditions are going to set up a few days in advance. As we get into the colder, since that occurred when the lakes were still relatively warm, that was a big event. It's going to be tougher for them to get similar sorts of deep accumulations because that lake temperature is cold, is chilled off considerably. So the lake effect snow is something that, again, is a pretty well forecast if you know the wind direction pretty well and you have the air temperature, the temperature, the lake temperature forecasted very well. For sort of the big snowstorms that give us the major accumulations in southern Wisconsin, Madison area, those are a little bit trickier just because there are a lot more factors that are involved in that.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Michael Morgan, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. He was with us to explain why we're in a cold snap right now and when it might start to warm up.
Coming up, we'll take your calls. It's our first really big cold in Wisconsin this winter. How do you deal with cold weather? Embrace it? Avoid it? What do you do instead of getting outside? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We want to hear from you about this weather. It's cold. I don't want to overhype it. We'll just call it cold-pocalypse. No, this isn't anything that far out of the ordinary, but the important weather sometimes is the weather right now. It's really quite cold out there. A lot of schools being canceled. And we want to hear from you. Do you love really cold weather? Hate it? What do you do to get through it? What do you do when school's canceled? How do you get the kids through the day? Are you having traumatic flashbacks to last year's fairly significantly cold winter? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. You and I souped up this last weekend, Veronica.
Soup is one way that I cope with the cold for sure. Another is pancakes and building a fire every night. We build fires.
So you don't even have a fireplace.
That's right. It's literally in the middle of my
living
room.
Metal bucket, rusty.
No, we have a fireplace. I do think, though, that people's reserves of stoicism may have been tapped and the stores are still being replenished. So I hope that we have it in us to get through this.
Yeah, there can be kind of an oh no, not again feeling after
right.
last winter.
Right.
Well, join in with your thoughts on the cold winter. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Lisa posted on Facebook, her car broke down this morning. Always a bummer, especially on a cold day. She said, the inconvenience and the realization of my dependence on an automobile infuriated me, had me swearing. Oh, wait, it goes on. Had me swearing to move somewhere that never freezes where I could walk, bike, or take public transport. Since the car is running again, I'm less angry, but the cold still sucks. It's not so bad that a little fantasizing about summer backpacking excursions can't make me feel better. Well, yeah, do you ever have that sense like, why do I live here when it's this cold? 800-642-1234, or you can join Lisa by posting on Facebook. We asked a lot of our coworkers, too. To share some of their feelings about the cold.
That's right. And I was just listening to you read Lisa's, wondering if there was a mashup of the words cold and angry, like there is for hangry. If you think of one, let us know, because I think it would have lots of application here in Wisconsin. Well, Joy Cardine show producer Bill Martin said, I really love it when I walk to the bus stop in the morning and the air actually hurts my face. That's the best thing ever.
I checked in with Bill that put sarcasm tags around that. He doesn't really like it, it turns out.
I could
have seen him going either way, actually, knowing Bill. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Nancy on the line at 800-642-1234. Nancy joins us in Duluth. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. When it gets weather like this, I just like to organize all the projects I've been putting off and do them, you know, things you don't like to do when it's nice and sunshiny out.
So what's your project for this cold snap?
Well, just the different things you've been putting off, like organizing things in your house or cleaning out a room or cleaning out a cupboard, and then call someone who's shut in that doesn't get out and make their day, and then cook something different that you haven't cooked for a while, because I love to cook and bake, and maybe deliver some of them to the people that are shut in.
Well, Nancy, that's great. I mean, I love that you're getting your projects done, but also it's great that you're reaching out to other people by phone or even maybe with some baked goods. That's lovely. I'd love to hear if other people do that sort of thing. Very inspirational. Or maybe you get out and shovel for someone who needs the help in this cold weather. 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
And we go next to Steve in Middleton. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Hey, I don't want to sound too much like a curmudgeon, but, you know, this is Wisconsin and it's winter. It's basically, you know, you deal with it or you don't. It'd be like, you know, complaining about the humidity in New Orleans in the summer.
So we really don't have any reason to be surprised that it's cold in winter if we live in Wisconsin. You make a valid point, Steve.
I'm not saying it's, you know, it's great all the time and there are, you know, detriments, but it is what it is, as the cliche goes.
All right, Steve, you're a good Wisconsinite. He's rolling with the punches in winter.
Exactly. Though I plan on complaining about the humidity in Wisconsin in the summer, too.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it gives us plenty to complain about. Braden is with us now in Hayward. Braden, hi. Oop, Braden, are you there? Okay, we've got Kathy then in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm loving this.
You love the cold.
Well, you know what? I love the snow. So I can't say just the cold by itself, but it's what I live for all year. And I just love to get out today, bundled up, ski goggles, went out and cross-country skied. And the interesting thing is, after being out in it, it doesn't feel as bad. So I know I'm an oddity here. My friends all think I'm crazy, but I find it exhilarating.
So while a lot of people in the winter are fantasizing about that warm weather hike, maybe you're spending all summer fantasizing about getting the coat and the hat and the mittens on?
I dream about snow, so I'm a true Norwegian. So it's in my blood.
Kathy, thanks. Oh,
I was just going to say, I think everybody needs to know somebody like Kathy in the winter. It helps get me through, because if I come in and I'm feeling bitter and angry about the cold, talking to someone who's really loving it can be the perfect antidote. So we need more Kathys out there to even out the feelings.
Well, we have one at Public Radio. Carill Owens, technical director for your old stomping grounds, Veronica, to the best of our knowledge, says I love really cold weather. The way the sound travels, the way the snow squeaks, the tingle on your skin, the clarity of the night sky, the blue tones in the snow. I could go on and on, she says. So, Carill, maybe talk to her when you need that winter inspiration.
Veronica. Doesn't that make you love winter more, just hearing the way she described it?
Ying. A little.
Okay, well, let's go on to Max in Milwaukee. Hi, Max.
Oh, hello.
What do you think about this weather?
Well, honestly, I really can't stand the cold, but there was kind of an unforeseen benefit in that it helped me quit smoking, which I had been trying to do for some time now. And I think the cold really just gave me that one last push.
Back inside.
Yeah, exactly. Staying inside.
Right, there is that, because you have to be a very hardy constitution to take those smoke breaks outside right now. So Max, seeing some benefits there.
Yeah, I always wonder, you know, hanging out at the bar with the people who smoke out front, and it's this kind of weather, you wonder how long can they keep going? And a lot of them do. They'll keep going out for the smoke break. But I would think that's an incentive, definitely. Well, back to our callers. We've got Emily on the line with us in Milwaukee. Emily, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What are your thoughts on this cold weather?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, and I, like, hated winter, and I was like, I hate it here. And then I moved to a place that was, like, 65 to 70 and sunny, like, 350 days out of the year, like, the perfect temperature ever. And I can tell you that it gets really boring. So boring. I literally, like, paid the $1,500 to fly back to Wisconsin for Christmas just so that I could experience something that was different. And so now, even though I'm a little bitter because it is cold, I am, like, I remember how bored I got when it was just the same day after day. So take heart. Even perfection gets boring.
Emily, thank you so much. So we don't know what we've got until we go away and miss that winter for a while.
See, that's the kind of perspective we need. This is a good session for us all.
Yeah, this is helping me.
Buck up. And we could also listen to Norman Gilliland, who says, about winter, I'm cool with it. Bundle up if there's snow, ski if there's ice, skate once per winter anyway. Couldn't do any of that when I lived in Florida. Also, I get quality thinking done while shoveling.
Wow, good for Norman. Well, let's try Adriana in Bayfield. Adriana, hi.
Hi. I think that your last caller may have been talking about California because I moved here from California in September of last year, right before the really bad winter. So I was very much enjoying the mild winter we were having, and I can't really complain about the bad days we've been having because by this point last year, we had had like 20 of these days up here in Bayfield. So it's not too bad. And I actually have come around to kind of enjoy the cold, at least when it's like not cold, like wet cold. If it's dry cold, I'm okay with it. If it's wet cold, I just can't stand it.
But let me ask you, I mean, California to Wisconsin in last year's winter, did that almost chase you away?
Oh, last year I got really bad cabin fever. I definitely probably had some seasonal depression going on last year. So I'm trying a lot more to get out and just kind of enjoy the winter, even if it's cold. If it gets anything above the teens, I try to go outside and at least get outside. So I think I'm a little bit healthier about it this year than I was last year. Last year I was just unhappy.
Great. We've got a good attitude, and hopefully we won't be back in the situation we were last winter.
Right.
All right. Let's take one more call here. I think we have time for Katie in Bayfield. Hi.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to call and let you know I love this cold weather because I'm a runner. I love going out to run. Negative 20 is my absolute favorite number because I don't sweat when I run, and it's great. Also, it's really good for snowboarding and seeing that that snow is so slick and you just cruise through it. It's so much fun to go in that with snow in their best condition.
I'm almost amazed at the joggers that I see. Yeah. 20 below zero, don't your lungs just freeze up?
Oh, it's great. No, you gotta wait and have a good scarf, good facial protection. If you've got the right gear to go outside any time of the year, just gear up. It's worth it. I'm kind of a cheap kind of a girl, but man, you can find some really good sales at those consignment stores. Get the good gear. It's worth it.
Okay, well, there's our challenge. The gauntlet is thrown down, Rob. You're going to go jogging tomorrow.
Ha.
We're not.
We shan't be doing that.
Well, thank you so much for all your calls and your advice and your pep talks for surviving the cold. You can keep that conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR.
We're gearing up for a lot of discussion this year on education. In his inaugural address yesterday, Governor Scott Walker mentioned the importance of education, made it a point to bring up school choice programs. Since this is going to be a priority in this term, we thought we'd lay some groundwork and get a basic understanding of how different kinds of schools in Wisconsin work.
Erin Richards is with us. She's an education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with some basic definitions. We're talking about traditional public schools, public charter schools, and voucher schools. Can you break it down? What are these different school types?
Sure. So everybody knows what public schools are. So let's start with charter schools and voucher schools. Charter schools are public schools. The word charter kind of stands for contract. So charter schools have a contract with a different entity, either a school board or in Milwaukee with the city of Milwaukee or with UWM, that says, we're going to give you a little bit of flexibility in how you run your school in exchange for meeting some performance targets. So that could be graduation, that could be achievement test targets on the state test. But charter schools are they're public schools. They answer to a school board or to a separate entity that the state has given the power to charter schools, and they have to have their own school board, and their meetings are public meetings. They are open. You can go to charter school board meetings. The teachers have to have, you know, credentials, state teaching licenses, but they can be run by independent companies. So there are some charter school networks and some independent nonprofits that run charter schools.
And before we get to voucher schools, how does a school become a charter school?
Well, somebody has to make a petition or create a proposal to ask a school board to charter their school. Or, like I said, in Milwaukee, which is a little bit different landscape than the rest of Wisconsin, in Milwaukee and the area around Milwaukee, you could approach the city of Milwaukee or UWM with a proposal for a school that you would like them to charter. So the proposals are usually pretty they have to be pretty robust, but technically anyone can propose a charter school.
And how about voucher schools? What do we know about them?
Voucher schools are always private schools, and it's really easy in this state to mix up voucher and charter school, but they're very different. Anytime you hear the word voucher school, that often means the same thing as a choice school. And voucher schools, again, are always private schools. They have existed for a long time in Milwaukee. They were created in Milwaukee back in 1990. So Milwaukee has a long-standing voucher school program. There are about 113 private schools in Milwaukee that accept publicly funded tuition vouchers for students to attend those schools. In more recent years, we've seen a voucher program start in Racine, and then 2 years ago, we started the statewide voucher program. And the philosophy behind voucher schools was to allow low-income students the opportunity to take a publicly funded tuition voucher to offset the tuition at a private school. And that private school may be, and often is, a religious school.
And where can we find these types of schools generally in Wisconsin? Are there more of them in certain areas than others?
Absolutely. So Milwaukee still has critical mass when it comes to voucher school students. So, for example, Milwaukee has about 27,000 students in these publicly funded but private, mostly religious schools. And most of these schools do teach religion. Many are Catholic, Lutheran, Christian. Racine has a four-year-old program. It doesn't have an enrollment cap on it, but it has far fewer students because it's much newer and Racine isn't as big as Milwaukee. The statewide voucher program, schools could submit applications from all over the state. So there are some voucher schools sort of flung all over the place at the moment. There's some in Appleton, sort of around the surrounding areas, and there are only about 1,000 students in that statewide program right now. When the legislature passed it 2 years ago, they wanted to cap the enrollment so that there weren't a ton of students that were in those schools already. And a big question in the legislature this year will be, should that enrollment cap be lifted? And if it is, how many more students statewide should be allowed to take taxpayer money to private, mostly religious schools in the form of vouchers?
Well, let's get into the numbers a bit now. How many students are enrolled in, say, public schools as compared to charter and voucher?
Oh, my goodness. There are far more kids in public schools than there are both in the charter schools and the voucher schools. I'm not certain about the statewide numbers of students in charter schools, but it's still a small slice of the population. In general, nationwide, about 90% of kids in the United States go to public schools. Only about 10% go to private schools. Those numbers may be a little bit different in Wisconsin because of the voucher program. But in general, the bulk of kids are still going to public schools. And statewide, if they're going to a charter school, it's chartered by, and again, we're back to these are public schools now. Charter schools are public. Statewide, all charter schools at the moment are chartered by local school boards. So it's kind of within the district. Those schools don't look a lot different than their normal public schools because they're still a part of the school district family.
Now, do the different kinds of schools that we've been discussing, do they draw different kinds of students typically?
Well, that depends. I think sometimes different types of students may go to schools that have a really good track record, but I think you'd see that across the sectors. Oftentimes, high-performing schools attract parents who want their kids in those high-performing schools. To participate in voucher programs, again, those are the programs that allow students of a certain income level to go to a private school with taxpayer money, there is an income threshold. So statewide, you still, in that program too, you have to be of low income or moderate income to use vouchers to go to a private school. Obviously, for public schools, there's no income requirement. Public schools take all kids. Charter schools also have to abide by state law because they're public. They are supposed to accept all students who come. The difference is with charter schools, if they have more applications for the school than they have seats, they have to hold a lottery. So that's, there's been some recent documentaries in recent years about kids trying to get into high-performing charter schools, and there's a lottery, and the kids that get picked out of the lottery get seats, and the rest are told, I'm sorry, we don't have room. So then those kids would either go back to a public school in their neighborhood, or depending on where they live in Milwaukee or statewide and what their income is, they might be able to take apply to a private school and apply to use a tuition voucher there.
Now, with a public school or a public charter school, if there's room, any student who wants to go, they can go. Do voucher schools have more latitude in who they accept?
They do have a little bit more latitude, but it's difficult. This is a gray area. There are a lot of people in the voucher school networks that say, listen, we are serving exactly the same kind of students, for example, that Milwaukee Public Schools is serving. And to a large part, and for years, that was true. I mean, these kids were in the city of Milwaukee, mostly low income. It had to be low income to participate in Milwaukee. Many of them were children of color, and they were coming from the same troubled backgrounds as many other kids in the inner city. Statewide, the student population in the new statewide voucher program, again, those are the kids that are attending private school statewide, many more of them are of moderate means, and we know that many of those kids were already in those private schools before they applied for a tuition voucher and then remained in the private school attending with the help of taxpayer dollars. So there is some difference there in the types of students being served, but part of it is the types of, we know the demographic and socioeconomic makeup of most kids that live in the inner city in Milwaukee and Racine, and we know the demographic and socioeconomic status of a lot of kids that live elsewhere in the state, in more suburban and more rural areas. More of the student population is white, low to moderate income.
Now, in terms of teacher qualifications, how do these schools differ in who works there, who teaches there?
This is a bigger definition or a bigger distinction between the sectors. In public schools, teachers have to have a bachelor's degree. They have to be state certified. They have to have a state teaching license. There's been some efforts in recent years to get some flexibility for that for charter schools. The philosophy being charter schools have some flexibility anyway. They're focused on they have to meet the performance standards in their contract with their chartering entity. And maybe they think that the best science teacher they could get is someone who has been a scientist all their life. And so there have been some efforts to try to get some flexibility on teacher qualifications and credentials for charter schools. But at the moment, they still need to have a state teaching license. Voucher schools are a different story. Again, these are private schools. The only thing the state requires that voucher schools have for teachers and administrators is a bachelor's degree. It does not have to be in education. They do not have to have a state teaching license. So the state is supposed to follow up with all of the private voucher schools and make sure that staff have those credentials. And that's a little bit harder for the media and other folks to independently verify because the schools are private, so they don't have to respond to open records requests where I could say, I would like to see your staff roster and all of the teachers and staff and their titles so I can independently verify that they have degrees. It's just harder for the public to get information about the private schools because they are, by nature, private institutions that don't have to follow the same open records, rules and laws that apply to charter and traditional public schools.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Erin Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to explain how public charter and voucher schools operate here in Wisconsin.